Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
You're listening to Unfiltered with James O'Brien, brought to you by Joe.
Hello and welcome to Unfiltered with James O'Brien. As you can probably tell, this isn't James O'Brien. I'm David Lammy, sitting in for James while he's away on his holidays. I appeared on episode 21 of Unfiltered back in March this year, so I was really pleased when Joe asked me to come back and to helm this episode featuring our very special guest, Idris Elba. Idris is an actor, a DJ, and now a feature film director. His debut film, Yardie, is out on the 31st of August, but I want to find out how a young man from Hackney went on to become one of the biggest stars this country has ever produced. Now, I last saw you when you were giving an amazing speech in Parliament on diversity. And I tried a few months ago to get you to join me, Lenny Henry, Adrian Lester,
yes,
and Ian Wright,
yes,
at the Chris Rock gig, yes, in the O2, and you couldn't make it.
I'm really
glad to see you.
Well, thank you for the invite. I was very touched by that, but we were in the midst of... I was talking about my nomadic experience. I was in the midst of moving and doing this, all sorts of things. So was it good?
Oh, it was wicked.
I'm sure.
He made a joke, though, about Tottenham. Mm. It was quite a rude joke. And I kind of feel like he knew I was in the audience. And I just sort of climbed under my chair as everyone sort of looked and pointed.
Really?
If you know what I mean. If he'd made it about Hackney, you might have done the same thing. But anyway, he was
great.
How
does Chris Rock actually say Tottenham? Does he say...
He said like that. So... I want to start at the beginning of this story, and the beginning of this story is very much you growing up in Hackney. And we're around the same age. Mm. You're a little bit younger than me. Mm. Obviously, look a lot better than me. Thank you very much. Make me feel fat as I sit here. But nevertheless, let's go back to the 1970s and to your wonderful Sierra Leonean and Ghanaian family. Mm. Which for me immediately conjures up wonderful fufu and jollof rice
food.
And Sierra Leoneans are also in West Africa known to be, they've got a fantastic sense of humour. So tell me about the home you grew up in.
You know, I'm an only child, it's me, my mum and dad. We lived primarily in a council flat in Queensbridge Road, Holly Street Estate. Number 9A, two-bedroom flat. And I grew up around adults. I grew up around my mum and dad, who were always working. My dad worked at Ford's and my mum worked as a clerical assistant, only child. So oftentimes go to school, they'd go to work, I'd come home, I'd have a key, I'd get in, I'd be by myself for a little while, depending on what dad shift my dad was on. And that was, you know, my upbringing. I was very close to my best friends because Again, I grew up around my adults.
And who were those best friends?
Well, my neighbour upstairs, Scott, who was one of my best friends, and a handful of kids at school. And, you know, I'll give you that picture just to say that, you know, growing up was great because I had my cousins and my mum and dad. But, you know, I spent a lot of time alone, if I'm honest. You know, I spent a lot of time playing by myself, to be honest, because it was just the way my parents worked. And, you know, I was mature for my age. So they would be like, you're big enough to let yourself in. You're big enough to go to school by yourself, da, da, da.
So you had that sort of experience. I certainly had it because I was being raised by a single mother where you'd get left on your own. You're told not to burn the house down. Open the door to anybody.
Yeah.
And basically, you've got to kind of mature.
Yeah. I remember my mum, you know, child support book come and she wouldn't be there. Yes. So she'd be like, go and get it yourself. I'm like, huh? And so I'd have to go do that, you know, and sign. And, you know, and the guy used to look at me. He used to know my mum, but he'd be like, mummy's at work? I was like, yeah. I was like, okay, I'm not supposed to give you your own book, but here you go. Here's the £7.52 or whatever it was. Big money. I take 50p, buy myself some Tutti Frutti's or something. And then, you know what I mean? I'm on my way home.
Was it a family that kept itself to itself? Your parents were obviously working hard. Or was there this sense of sort of more eclectic, extended family that sometimes is common in the sort of black or immigrant experience?
Yeah, my dad's brother lives here. He had five children, so we were always in and out of each other's houses. My dad came to England in the very late 60s and brought a few friends that he grew up with who also settled in. So there was a, you know, a grouping of family and friends around us. My dad was quite a socialite. You know, he loved the pub. We used to have all sorts of friends in the pub, all sorts of walks of life coming from our house. At work, he was quite a sort of a leader. He ended up being a shop steward for the union. You know,
and that was, you know. So now the pub in those days, my dad, when he was around, also liked the pub. Certainly the pub in Tottenham was a sort of Irish West Indian Cockney affair. Would that have been the same?
Exactly just the same. Yeah, actually the owner, he was white. His missus was black and the pub was very Irish, very black, very African, you know, very Jamaican. And that was the hub. And my uncle, who was a DJ, used to play there on a Friday, and you'd hear everything from, you know, some Congolese music right down to, you know, Dire Straits. You know what I mean? Like, it was a real mix.
And you were hanging out in the pub as a young teenager?
Yeah, all the time. Before I was a teenager, because I moved from Hackney by the time I was 11. Actually 12. So my dad used to take me down to the pub. And but them times there, you know, it kids could go in pubs. They had a little community garden. My dad was a bit of a pool shark. I used to watch him play, learn. Really interesting times.
So he was smooth, your dad?
Yeah, my old man was smooth. Yeah, he's a smooth guy. Yeah, everyone loved Winston because he had a big smile. He would assimilate your accent. If you were Jamaican, he'd be like, yo, man! You know? And if you were Indian, he'd be like, that's my brother. Listen, my brother, you know, he was that guy.
I mean, so you've got quite a lot from your dad, clearly.
Yeah. My dad is very, you know, big, big personality in my life, for sure.
Most immigrant families want their children to be doctors, accountants, lawyers. Mm. So as you started to transition with music and then into acting, what was the reaction to that? I'm trying to work out how has this happened?
It was a mixed bag. You know, it was a mixed bag. Academia, you know, my parents were big on academia. My dad, he came to England on a scholarship and he was doing marketing. And his only son was suddenly, you know, talking about being on the stage. It didn't quite relate to his dreams of me, you know, having a degree and whatnot. And the first thing he said to me about acting is that actors don't make money. You know, that was the first thing he said. And my mum always, you know, she loved when I would, you know, be the sort of life of the party, doing impressions, doing a new dance, you know, DJ, and she loved it, clapping. But then when it came to reality, you know, my GCSEs, I got average scores, but A plus in drama. She was like, well, I suppose you're going to be an actor then. I was like, yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, there wasn't a disappointment for my parents, but there was a warning. There was all these warning signs, you know, like, you know, get a job. And before you know, at 14, I was already working Saturday job, two Saturday jobs, you know. Then I was, before, by the time I left school, I was working with my dad in Ford's. You know, this idea that you have to work no matter what it is you're doing, you have to work at it.
And that was instilled early. What did you learn from those jobs? I mean, I found myself working at Kentucky Fried Chicken, McDonald's, security guard. Every single holiday was working. But that was because we needed the money. And I wasn't getting pocket money or extra money from my mother. So I had to work. And working, often you sort of, you know, you're with older people for whom this is their regular job. What did you, certainly working at Ford on a night shift, what did you learn about yourself? What did it teach you?
Independence. It taught me independence. And by the way, you know, like I said, I grew up a lot by myself, you know, having older parents, you know. My dad was 33 when I was born. My mum was 27. So, you know, my parents were, you know, running around in the park with me when I was 10. You know, they were like getting on, you know, a little bit. And independence. I had independence. I got to these jobs. I think my first job was a tire fitter. And I had to drive cars. I was entrusted to drive people's cars. And he asked me if I had a driver's license. I lied and said yes. And that was an independent thought. I remember, if I say no, I don't get this job. And I couldn't drive, but I said, oh, yeah, I can drive. And he believes me. He gave me the keys to a car to move. I figured it out on the spot. And the independence, that sort of, you know, you've just got to do this, otherwise you don't get what you want. When I was about 15, I went to a boys' school. I grew up in Canning Town. Canning Town at the time was a real sort of, all the lads were like trendy lads, you know, you have to keep up with the Joneses. Mum and dad would buy me high tech. I was like, I can't wear that.
Please don't buy me high tech. I can't buy me Tesco's best. You know what I
mean? Can't wear high tech at school. I'm going to get beat up, you know what I mean? Yeah. So my whole thing was about just independence, yeah.
Who are you? I mean, you've stressed that you spent a lot of time on your own. Mm. Who are you when you're on your own? Who was that young Idris? Was there a burning ambition? Are you reflective? What sort of person are you?
I was always someone that wanted to be someone else.
Well, that happened.
Yeah, did you understand? Yeah. Like, I grew up in an era where if you were West African and you had a funny name, that was like a kick in the teeth immediately. If you were dark skin and you happened to have ashy elbows or ashy skin, you was getting cussed out by all the West Indians. You know, I was just like, ah, man, I wish I was like that. I wish I was like that. Weirdly enough, I remember, you know, sort of thinking, oh, I wish I was a slightly different complexion. Yeah. Or I wish my name wasn't Idrissa. Do you know what I mean? Like, I wish it was Jason. And as I became sort of a teenager, had my own money, my body formed, my manhood become who I am, I started to see that I was actually quite different from everyone. And I embraced that. So when I was on my own, it was a combination of sort of watching people that I admired and trying to hone myself into being a bit like them, but being myself.
Who did you admire?
Daley Thompson.
Daley Thompson, who was huge.
Daley Thompson was like
doing so well in the Olympics.
The most incredible athlete, sports stars. I remember, you know, a lot of footballers. Sports stars.
I think you've said in the past that you thought you could have been a footballer.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, I was in the first team of all sports in my school, from cricket to hockey to trampolining, first team swimming, good footballer. I played it all, rugby, I played it all, and I was just like able-bodied to do it. I ran for Newham Beagles. Yeah. I was the second fastest in Newham at one stage, you know, 100 metres. And it was just like this natural ability to just... But it was a lot to do with this idea that I just want to be as good as someone else. I just want to be as good as. It was literally a mindset. I want to be as good as that. I want to be as good as that. Even if I was making Lego, I would look at someone that was naturally good at it and look at mine and be like... I can't make mine look like that. I remember that
it
very early.
It sounds like there's definitely quite a lot in your character that drove you to kind of want to be the best. I mean, if you were good at sport, you were succeeding. If you had the desire to start to excel in acting, it sounds like there wasn't the kind of teacher, youth worker who kind of picked you up and started to make it happen. Quite a lot was going on in you, right?
Yeah, but the truth is that there was, in my drama teacher, Miss McPhee, in a boys' school, you know, the competition is ridiculous. You know, I wasn't the best footballer. There were kids that were amazing, that were incredible, but I wanted to be as good as them. And I remember my drama teacher just going, you can only be the best you. That's what you can do. You can't be John. You can be the best Idris. And that resonated with me massively. And I found myself, like, in drama, the best actor, the best communicator, the best director, the best scene writer, the best, it was like, out of all the competition. And it was a bit weird because drama was seen as a bit of a, it was the only class that people could have a laugh in, to be honest, because it was a boys' school and they were tough.
Yeah.
Miss McPhee was blonde, beautiful, and she wasn't weak, but the boys took the piss a little bit. So,
How did you combine that? Because obviously, in some arenas, being an actor, being a bit thespian, you know, might not be seen as the most macho masculine thing to do. I mean, I was singing in my school and got quite a lot of the piss taken out of me. So how was that sensibility? You're obviously very comfortable with that. Maybe it's because you were good at sport as well.
I'll answer that question if you sing a song now. Like, no, let's just get this out. You're not going to make a statement come on.
You're just, I can't
Let
do
this
that.
Be a radio first.
I cannot do that. I don't want to make headlines. You want to make headlines.
One day I'm going to interview you, and that is definitely coming back up.
You've got a deal.
All right, cool. When Miss McPhee was like, lads, we're doing this, and you're doing it, and you're being marked on it, everyone paid attention. And they would come to me and be like, what do we do? What do we do? What do we do? I found myself directing very, very early, you know, scenes. And, you know, in a boys' school, you had to play a mummy and a daddy, and everyone would be like, I'm not playing the mummy. And I'd be like, I'll do it, whatever, I'll do it. And be good at it. And they're like, you're really good at that. But, you know,
I just can't see it as a mummy. I'm sorry.
It's not a role that I revisited much. But the point is that I was so passionate about this idea of being someone else that it just transferred into acting. So, like, it just became very easy to me. And I guess, you know, you get to a certain age in secondary school where, you know, you either go with the crowd or you go on your own. Mm-hmm. And if you go on your own, you're choosing to be a bit solitaire. You're choosing that. And I did that. It just so happens, though, I was good at all the other stuff, so they didn't take the piss out of me as much.
What would be your advice to a young you sitting in Hackney, sitting in Tottenham, sitting in Brixton, sitting in Sunderland, about the confidence that it requires to go your way? What would be your advice looking back? What would you want to say to that young person?
I think the advice I would have is just to be organized with your thoughts. You know, I'm very much a go with the flow kind of person. You know what I mean? And I still am to this day. And if I was a lot more organized, I'm not sure if I'd be the same me, but I'd be successful. Do you know what I mean? I'd be more successful, more efficient. But I think, though, I meandered around my career for a while. When I moved to America, I had 4 years of not getting any work. And that was partly to do with being organized, partly to do with the luck, layer of the luck, you know, of sort of my career choice. But having organization sort of, that's the one thing I couldn't do. Like, I could imagine being someone else and being as good as them. But the guy that was great at Lego had all his red bricks over there, all his black bricks over there, all his green bricks over there. I just had every bricks together and just, like, could try and, you know, emulate him. So I would give anyone advice about whatever they're deciding to do is just be organized. And it doesn't mean just to be sort of, like, overly critical about the way you've set up your life. Is just to be prepared. Be prepared for what might come at you. Because if you're disorganized when something comes at you, then it's an easy wipeout. But if you're organized, you end up sort of being able to weather the storm a little bit. Which is what, you know, now I rely on a really amazing team who are organized. And there are good times and bad times, but they don't feel too sway because ultimately we're all prepared for it.
So let's go back to the States. That's a big decision. And again, you know, I see a slight similarity because I went to America. I think there's often, isn't there, an odyssey of black men that want to be successful going perhaps to America. There's certainly an acting, but, you know, in my circumstances, I went to university there and drew a lot from that African-American experience. But being in New York on your own cannot have been easy. There must have been some low moments. Tell us about that.
I wasn't on my own. I was married at the time. I got married very early in my life, about 25, 26, and we went with our savings, not much money, landed. And it was, you know, when you go on holiday and you go, I love it here, I can live here. I did that for a few years in New York.
Right, okay.
And then ended up living there. And as soon as you got there, the reality of life just kicks in, you know.
Where were you living?
When I arrived, I lived on 34th Street. I mean, literally, like, living in Leicester Square or something, you know. And then soon that was eating out my rent, my allocated rent funds. And we moved to Brooklyn very quickly. Yeah. But I'd sort of, at the point I moved to America, I sort of had a career in England, which was a good one. It was on television regularly. But, I really, that sort of beacon, you know, the Denzels, the Wesley Snipes, the Taye Diggs, these guys were just, like, killing it. And I wanted that. And that's what kept me going, you know. I think that's what you said, there's an odyssey of black people leaving England, going to the American experience, because it feels from a different perspective, looking over there, that, wow, the grass is greener for sure. Look at all those successful black people. Look at those successful actors. Wow, you know, that's Wesley Snipes, he's leading a movie. At one point, he was like 20 million a picture. That's impossible in our country. And that was very much part of my journey, very much, you know, I sort of looked at that.
What sort of acting parts did you get in those early days?
In America?
Yeah.
I didn't work for 4 years, so I did a play for Sir Peter Hall, the late Sir Peter Hall. He did Troilus and Cressida off-Broadway, and I did an episode of Law and Order. And then I would fly back for smaller parts in bits and pieces in this country.
You were picked up for The Wire by someone who saw you in Troilus and Cressida. Is that right?
Well, you know, Troilus and Cressida was a showpiece of inviting New York casting directors to come. And a New York casting director came. She was amazing. She was lovely. Kim Misha, her name was. And she said, I really like this kid. I'm going to introduce him to someone that I think might help him. They introduced me to Philip Carson and another agent that had a small company. And they loved me. And, you know, they began me on this journey of doing the rounds of going up for auditions, meeting different casting directors. And in one of those rounds, I met Alexa Fogel, who is the casting director for The Wire, who put me up for various things over the last 2 years of my, before I got The Wire.
We'll get back to Idris in a moment, but first let me tell you a little bit more about his new movie. Yardie is the directorial debut from Idris Elba. A young man haunted by the murder of his brother leaves Kingston, Jamaica to embark on a bloody, explosive quest for retribution through the Sound Clash cruise and dark underworld of 1980s London. Book your tickets for Yardie now at yardiefilm.co.uk. It's in cinemas on August the 31st. Now here's Russell Cain to tell you about his show on Joe.
Hi, Russell Cain here, and I'm hosting a brand new podcast for Joe, Boys Don't Cry, where I get a bunch of men together and force them to talk about the things we never talk about. Body hair, body shape, why do girls only fancy bastards? All the things we worry about but never discuss. Oh, and I'll also have a girl helping me each week just to make sure we're not talking rubbish. So go to wherever you get your podcasts, iTunes, wherever, and download Boys Don't Cry now.
Thanks, Russell. Now back to Idris Elba. You threw yourself into Stringer Bell. I mean, I remember watching The Wire in early days as a young MP in the evening. I'd be sort of, you know, where's The Wire? And you just flew out the screen. It's an iconic character. What was it like to play? How do you feel about that character now, looking back?
At the time, it was a small role in a TV show. It was a massive opportunity for A, me to come out of poverty, and B, you know, be seen on a HBO show.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I don't think it was ever written to be the legacy it's become. It was really designed to be, you know, a smaller role next to the main role for one season. And, you know, HBO started to witness what was happening in terms of the audience response, in terms of the story writing, and actually reality as to what was happening in Baltimore. Mm. And it became a slightly different role and became bigger and snowballed. And to be honest, it became what it is in terms of its iconography much later.
I've sensed some discomfort, though, from you when talking about it a few years later, because in the end, he was a drug dealer. Mm-hmm. And so I've sensed that you haven't wanted to completely big him up as the best thing since sliced bread. I think once you were asked to choose a favourite scene, and it was actually his death.
Well, I think that, you know, the death, the celebration of his... I felt it was a very brave thing to do, and ultimately a big statement. So we're all idolising Stringer Bell, okay? But who are we really idolising? Are we idolising a smart drug dealer or a dumb narcotics dealer? Mm. Like, what are we saying here? Is it okay to pump a community full of heroin, but because you're smart at it, that makes you cool? Like, that was a problem for me, you know. It wasn't a problem at the time I was working as an actor, but then when I realised I'm being celebrated for something that, okay, yeah, drug dealing, okay, but why can't he, what if he was a really smart politician, you know, smashing open doors in that way? Would we celebrate him as much? Doubt it. We celebrate him because he's a drug dealer and we can put him in a box. But, oh, by the way, he's learning in school and he's very articulate. You know, the irony of it used to just make me laugh, you know. And I suppose there was not bitterness about it at all. You know, I think it was a very brave move on the writer and HBO to behead one of the main characters at the height of his thing. Because the truth of the matter is, you know, most drug dealers go to jail at some point in their lives. They get caught. No matter how successful they are, no matter how good to the community they are, they will end up getting caught because what they're doing is illegal. And that's the truth of the matter. So as much as people celebrated the character, the harsh reality is that you either get shot or go to jail.
I mean, Idris, I sometimes find myself reflecting on the Tottenham in which I grew up. Mm. And how easy it is to navigate British inner city life today. How easy is it for a young Idris to navigate Hackney or Canning Town and make it out, particularly in the context of drugs and crime? And I know that you've been a very conscious actor. Certainly you've spoken out about housing, literacy for adults, and certainly about violence and gang crime and opportunities for young people. Mm. As you grow to more maturity, do you reflect on that and sort of worry about the ability to make it out with all the temptations of quick money that exists and the problems of drugs in communities like the ones we grew up in?
Of course. I mean, like, I'm always conscious about what popular culture, music, film, whatever you want to call it, social media, is encouraging, is teaching our youth, you know what I mean? My assistant's son is 14 years old. He's a lovely kid. And I look at him and think, you know, the music he likes, the clothes he likes, you know, he's got his eyes all over pop culture. And it only takes him to idolize the wrong person before he goes down that route, okay? Now, for me, it's important, as I keep talking about individualism, and you know, I got a job very early, such. The reason that is important is because you have to have your own mind. You can't blame society for everything. You've got to be able to have your own thoughts. You know what I mean?
Amen.
And I think that's. I read on Twitter the other day, and this kid, he had highlighted some tune I had done on YouTube, and he said, you know what? When he just does things like this, it makes me think I can do whatever the fuck I want. And I remember thinking, that was the biggest compliment, because I'm not known for making music particularly, but whatever he thinks about me, he didn't know that about me. And then suddenly he's like, wow, I can do whatever I want. I don't have to follow a route. I don't have to be wowed by everything I'm seeing in a video, or, you know, actually I can follow my own route. And that's important.
I think you're probably also a role model big time, because you're what they call, to use fancy words, a bit autodidactic. You are self-taught in music and in acting, in a sense. You didn't go to a big fancy drama school. Mm. You kind of made it happen yourself, right? Mm. Mm. And so that business of doing your own thing, which again has got a sort of African make and mend sensibility, is quite strong in you.
Yeah, it is, for sure. It's definitely to do with, again, individualism. It's about, I don't have fear of failure. You know, failure for me is another opportunity. That's really how I see it. Those moments where, you know, you'd be, I went to a boys' school, and if you said the wrong word in class, everyone would clown you. And then it would be shame for like 2-3 minutes. I never feared that. I would stumble on a word, get the laughter, and keep doing it until I got it right. And that's just my personal thing. Not everyone's built like that, but that's where, you know, I celebrate people that can think on their own. Because if you worry about fear, if you worry about failure, you definitely will not do anything. And that's the only thing I can say. I don't have any particular amazing ability, but my ability is to overlook fear. So therefore, if I overlook fear and I mess up 15 times, it's okay to keep doing it until I start getting good. And then guess what? You become really good at it.
Because yes, of course.
Because you just overcome that moment.
Yeah.
And actually, I think a lot of picking drama at a very young age, where everyone would clown you if you got up and, all right, so kids, who's going to jump up and pretend to be a fried egg? Man's would be like, no. And I'd be on that floor popping and doing it. Yeah, they'd be like, it's just so stupid. Yeah. But before you know it, everyone's doing it. And who's the best fried egg? And that's you know what I mean? Yes. Like, that mentality came from not just confidence, but just, I'm an individual, innit? You know, that's really where it comes from.
Now, today, the Indris that sits here is absolutely a Hollywood leading man. You had in this country probably the breakthrough performances, Luther. You seem to be working the whole time, juggling being a parent, but really throwing yourself into these huge roles. How has that roller coaster been for you over the last few years?
Tiring. it's been incredible. Like I said, you know, the celebrated moments are incredible. Coming back to England, being able to get a role like Luther, become a coveted, iconic role again, was an incredible thing. But then it's about the maintenance of that, trajectory and that momentum. When you have a career that lives also in the States, as it does here, that's double the work. You do have to sort of spread yourself a little thin. It's been an amazing time. It's been a time where I've been able to sort of secure my family and my finances and, you know, my health. And, you know, that stuff is amazing. Because a lot of the time as an actor, you grow, you hand to mouth, you know, that's it. Yeah. And when you can get to a stage where you don't have to work for the money, that becomes very, very freeing. But it also means you have to maintain that. You know, you have to maintain that. So I can say that it's been the best time of my life. I've had some amazing tragedies within the same time, which aren't that public, to be honest. But there's been amazing times where I've had low points. But I'm blessed. I'm very lucky. The fact that we're sitting here, I got to direct Yardie. I know you'll get onto that, but being a director in a feature film for a feature film in our country was like one day I'm going to do that. Definitely one day I'm going to do that. And to sit here and talk about the film I've directed now is amazing. I'm there.
Well, let's do that. Mm. So I've seen the film. It is a wonderful, wonderful film. I am hugely biased because it's a film that takes me back to the 80s, takes me back to, in this context, a Jamaican culture, a West Indian culture. The film is both shot in Jamaica and in London. Yeah. It could have been just a tale, obviously based on Victor Headley's book, but it could have been a tale really of a sort of London underworld. Mm. But this is a film that also has a spiritual and ritual quality to it as it sort of pans back to Jamaica and sort of a sort of ancestral past. So it's rich in colour and feel. Huge achievement.
Thank you, David.
Tell me about how this came to pass. When did you know about the book? How did you get engaged?
The book was, you know, you're the same age as me, so we might have read it originally in the same time, which was late 80s, early 90s, but late 80s, as far as I remember, it becoming, you know, in you know, Afro-Caribbean community popular. Yardie, have you read Yardie? Have you read Yardie? Do you know what Yardie's about? And the term Yardie was earlier, you know, the term Yardie. I remember in the 80s watching the news, the war on the Yardies, you know, that was a big deal. You know very well,
yeah,
Tottenham,
violence,
Hackney, Peckham, you know, these areas, West London. There were big Jamaican communities where Scotland Yard were going at it. It was Yard, Scotland Yard versus Yardies,
yes,
basically.
That's right.
And but the book came obviously as a spawn from that. It was something that I read when I was younger. I didn't read many books, but Yardie was one of them. I remember I could relate to Dee. I could relate to the character. I knew, growing up in Hackney especially, which is much earlier in my life than I read the book, but growing up, I kind of knew those characters. Mm. I saw that area. Mm. I knew it. And Victor really written it, you know, with that sort of novelistic approach, just to make you turn the page. And then this happened, and the violence and the descriptions of it all. So it really hit my, you know, sort of my consciousness. Fast forward to, you know, about 4 or 5 years ago, where a script came across my desk.
Why did it come across your desk?
I don't know. I think at that point, you know, I'd put out quite publicly that my ambitions to direct our community is a small community. So that's, I think, right. I did some small things where someone said to Warp Films, if you thought about Idris, this might be interesting for Idris. Idris is a DJ. Idris has this some background that might help amplify this story. And that's how it came to me. And I was like, are you joking? Like, I couldn't believe that Yardie was sitting on my desk as an opportunity for me to direct. Had the meeting, and we spoke, just like we're speaking now, about my experiences, about why I think I could make this work, what I liked, what I didn't like about the film, about the script. And the approach from the writer of the original screenplay, Brock N. Brock, was very spiritual. He had taken on board some of the very subtle parts of the book that spoke about spiritualism and spoke about this journey, and he embellished that, which essentially, the film that we've got now is a combination of all of that. You know,
you've got some amazing performances from Stephen Graham as the most scary drug lord. I mean, you know, this was kind of string a bell on speed. And the young actors, the two young leads.
Amel Amin.
And Miss Jackson.
Yes, Chantel Jackson.
That's right. I mean, how did you do that? What was it like being behind the camera? It looked very easy on the eye. Beautiful, I would say.
Well, those are very talented actors. You know, we spoke in depth about being honest Amel is part Jamaican, part Trinidadian, and Chantel I cast in Kingston after a lengthy casting process. And, you know, they both came to the project with their arms open, like, please. Because the ambition for the piece was not to ham up any parts of the culture, not to ham up any of the violence, not to ham up any of what we think Jamaican culture is. The idea with my cast and my producers was to be really authentic, even if it meant alienating some people, which is, you know, quite honestly... You know, this is not a mainstream film because, you know, unless you are you can understand Jamaican culture a little bit, you may be lost. Okay, but it is a mainstream film in the sense that there is a moral tale within it that is universal. So, City of Gods, for example, was one of the films that we spoke as a wonderful film, but not one of us, you and I don't know, but I don't speak Portuguese. No. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I've never been to Brazil. Yes. Watching that film while reading subtitles, and it had a profound effect on me.
Yes. Absolutely.
It's because there's a tale in it. There's a tale in it that I can relate to. And that's what we try to do with Yardi.
I guess, though, in West Indian culture and Jamaican culture, because of the hybridity and its proximity to Britain in terms of empire and things, there is a sensibility that I think in this film that people can tap into, and indeed yourself as Sierra Leonean, that Creole. You know, well, certainly when I've been in Sierra Leone, it has felt like I'm in the Caribbean as well. So that must have been something that you felt you could tap into, because I thought the film was very accessible.
In the 3 years, 4 years developing that film, there's been a real upsurgence of West African music, and these guys are singing in broken English practically, you know, and it's pop is the biggest type of music now. I remember growing up, if you spoke anything like near an African accent, you might as well get stoned, you know what I mean? So it was encouraging, because I was like, well, if they can listen to Nigerian music and Ghanaian music and sing along, then Jamaican, a film with Jamaican dialect that's pure, isn't going to be too much of a challenge. And, you know, we've been thanked for not diluting the film down, especially in our country. And in places like America, some American audiences have been like, well done. I mean, it was a struggle, but we got it. We got the sensibility, and we weren't kid gloved with fake accents, you know, you got real Jamaicans. And that was a real compliment for us, you know. It's been alienating for some audiences, but, you know, for most people get it and appreciate it.
What has been the toughest moment in directing and making this happen?
The toughest, I mean, there are so many variables to that answer, to be honest, but I think, you know, my ambition for the film was to make something that was as culturally specific as Goodfellas is to the Italian culture, but have a worldwide appeal. And that's a tough thing to do. It's just tough. The ingredients are sparse, you know, it's hard to do that. And just keeping that vision alive, there was moments where, you know, we felt maybe we should just water this down a little bit. And then, you know, making that decision and saying, nope, let's keep it as it is. Let's not overcook it.
Right.
That was the toughest thing, keeping on to that vision. We're an amazing team. So even the tough moments were spread evenly amongst producers, actors and direct and the crew. We got there.
So you have been a DJ, musician, actor, now directing.
You forgot a rapper, though, man. How are you going to forget rapping? Sorry, come on, man.
Okay, rapper as well.
I just keep throwing it in.
You're just making me feel really bad because I'm just a politician. You know, Mr. Boring from Tottenham versus Mr. Cool from Hackney. I've had to face this all my life.
What you do as a politician requires as much bandwidth as any director or any writer would have to have. Yeah, for sure.
Thank you. But what's the future for you? What is it, you know, do you want to direct more clearly? You want to, I mean, because across these two continents, you know, Luther, TV, film, What's the future? What should people be looking out for?
For me, it's like, you know, more of the same. You know, I'm an entertainer. So anything that lives in that under that title is where I think I live the best. I think that at some point I want to hand the baton on, so that will take the sort of form of education of some sort, educator of some sort. Mm. I definitely feel like my legacy is to be able to teach some of what I know, which isn't particularly academic, but it's about that life, that individualism, it's that perspective. And that may take the form as a program, a school, an academy, whatever that is. I definitely feel like somewhere in my journey, some sort of education opportunity will be there.
Well, it chimes with that theme of giving back and being conscious. Mm. And I think, certainly from where I'm sitting, I'm grateful for that.
Yeah, thanks, man.
I'm also grateful to Joe for this opportunity. This has been a wonderful, wonderful interview. Thank you so much, Idris Elba. Go out and watch Yardi. It was fantastic.
I appreciate that, man. Thank you.
Thanks, brother.
That's great talking to you, really.
So what do we learn about Idris from this interview? I never knew that he grew up so lonely and spent so much of his childhood on his own. I think we also saw his discomfort around some aspects of his Stringer Bell character in The Wire. He talked a bit, really, about the context of crime now in inner-city Britain and elsewhere, and about whether we should laud someone like that or condemn him, which I thought was really, really interesting. And, of course, the confidence he's grown into. He was delighted at the opportunity to direct this new film, Yardi. He positively glowed, really, about that opportunity. And one really thought about a young Idris reading the book back in the late 80s and then getting this opportunity now to direct the film. The film's out on the 31st of August. And if you enjoyed this interview, you might want to check out Mark Hamill's episode of Unfiltered. Here's a clip.
In Star Wars, I was 24 playing 18.
Yeah.
Carrie was truly 19. In fact, I remember when they said, you're going to go meet Carrie tonight, and I was thinking she's 19. She's just out of high school, you know, and I'm a worldly 24. Then I meet her, and she has the composure and the demeanor of someone 10 years older than me.
And she also managed to cram into a month more than most people cram
into a decade. Within an hour of meeting her, she's telling me these hair-raising details about Debbie and Eddie's marriage, where I'm thinking, should I be hearing this? I mean, really, she had no barriers. Like, she would just open up and tell you things. You know, I thought later, it's almost like I was an old family friend for 15 years. Because I never would have been that revealing about those kinds of things about my parents. Certainly not the first time I met someone.
Is what makes her memoir so riveting.
Well, she was one of a kind.
Do go back and check that out, along with the rest of the back catalogue. While you're there, make sure you subscribe to Unfiltered, leave a rating and review on iTunes, and if you know someone who might like Unfiltered, introduce them to it.
You're listening to Unfiltered with James O'Brien. Brought to you by Joe.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince.
Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.